bread. Bread. Hey, it's your producer pal, Grogroot. Wait, Grogroot's trainer. It's your producer pal, Grugrux Dave, and this is 70mm Rejected, a podcast for 70mm fans just like you. With me today, but not always, is some guy, gal, non-binary pal I know from the internet, Dime.
Hello.
And introducing for the first time to the show, one of our editors, Village Meme Creator Extraordinaire, and my friend and fellow PDX pal, Paul.
Hi, this is Paul Allen. I've been called away to London for a few days. Meredith, I'll call you when I get back. Hasta la vista, baby.
Every episode is selected from one of our many movies that 70mm has thrown in the trash heap, but we managed to extract them before it got too funky and too smelly.
That's right, Dime. For the next few episodes, we're going back to October 2021, where Poltergeist won out over 15 other films as part of a, we'll call it a Creep 16 horror bracket. You know, when the rejected team sees all of those goody-goodies left over on those plates, you can literally hear our mouths salivating.
Exactly. And from the 15 leftover movies, we decided on three for the darker side of our love and hate season two theme. So this week, our journey continues with Mary Harron's American Psycho.
And as always, we discuss a bit about our thoughts on the movie and read the villagers' reviews live on air. But first, let's get started with the village update. Dave, back to you.
Thanks, Dime. You know, what can we say about this part of the podcast? I think it's one of the more favorite parts of the podcast. We like movies, but we're here to talk about the village, things that are going on in the village. One of the big things that Paul and I got to experience and are currently in the midst of here in the month of March is a barrage of visitors heading to the Portland Northwest area. And we got to spend some time with our other producer and friend, Ben. We got to see Love Lies Bleeding, and that was recently talked about briefly in the Criterion Connection with Ian and Mackenzie. They had a wonderful little preview to that conversation that hopefully they'll get deeper into later down the road. But Paul and I got to see that movie together. And then wonderful Ismail, talks a lot about collecting those Thanos stones. He collected a few more stones himself. Got to see certain women with us up here in Hollywood, the Hollywood Theater, and had a Q&A with the director, Kelly Reichardt, which was pretty amazing. And then his last day here, we got to see Problemista, which I guess is not even playing in San Diego, so go us.
Really?
I don't know. Hands down to the San Diego area. You got to get better Problemista screenings down there for Ismail. But yeah, those are some of the fun things to do. And then our friend Becky will be here in a couple of days for the Women's National Tournament. I think we're going to have the Sweet 16 and the Elite here in Portland. So, you know, just going ahead and proving once again that Portland is the West Coast spot for any future meetups. But, you know, a lot of mini meetups going on as well. I know that there was a meetup for some of the Philly folks with the Godzilla 1954 original run, and then Slim got to see RoboCop. I don't have a child per se, but I can't imagine the feeling Slim must have felt turning and seeing his young one, his sire, five-star, his favorite movie of all time.
I feel like if I was Slim, I would just be not even watching the movie. I'd just be watching him the whole time, just like reacting to everything that I love about that movie. Just like that would be just almost more entertaining to me. Uh-huh. But that's really special. That's really cool.
I think I'm most jealous about the fact that Slim's son has letterboxed this early in his life and can start kind of tracking films for the rest of eternity, for as long as Letterboxd exists, where folks like us, we have to go back and be like, wait, did I see that? Did I not see that? Okay, I guess I'll put watched and call it a day. So yeah, very excited.
Let me check my old ticket stub, make sure I saw that on that certain day. And I can, exactly. Like, I have an old box of like just ticket stubs from when I went to the movies all the time. It's like, okay, I could literally log movies if I wanted to back from June 1998 or something like that. Like, yeah, very special. We have Letterboxd.
I think I've only saved the real, at the time, were very blockbustery. Like I have my Independence Day opening day ticket. I have all of the re-releases for the Star Wars film. Nice. So, yeah, I think Letterboxd, again, just doing yeoman's work and lifting folks, being able to categorize and keep diary tabs of all of the things that are coming and going in the movie world. But speaking of coming and going in the movie world, there was a big buzz around possible new James Bond casting.
Oh,
but there was a discussion of maybe it was going to be somebody, then it was not going to be somebody. Was it Aaron Taylor Johnson, right?
Uh-huh.
Famed Marvel and a variety of different recent shows. What are your thoughts? Would you have, if the announcement was real, we don't know, could still be real. Do you think he would have fit in as a Bond?
I think so. I mean, I think he has a good look. I definitely like him. I've seen a couple of movies of his that, I definitely appreciate it. So I think, he would have the sort of right vibe if they're going with a, sort of younger James Bond. I think, that would be a nice touch. But, but like you said, I guess we'll have to see if the rumors are true or not.
Yeah, I only have a very limited viewer filmography of Aaron Taylor Johnson. So everything I know him from is either from the Kick-Ass movies or just from like little bit roles I've seen him in. So I'm not going to say that he wouldn't be good, but like maybe it would be okay. And like, I felt kind of maybe the same way about when Daniel Craig was cast. Like, I don't know who this person is, and the blonde thing never bothered me, but I'm like, this unknown, that's a little bit scary, but look how that turned out. It turned out to be great. So I have a little bit of faith in who they pick, but I don't know. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. I think trying to stay on top of any type of internet casting is a fool's errand. The amount of rumors, changes, things of that nature. I mean, to your point, Paul, everybody got up in arms when there wasn't an internet and they announced Michael Keaton as Batman. And now, so many years later, he is revered and idolized as the quote unquote Batman for many, many folks out there. So, yeah, I think a lot of it will be based on the story that they write for him. And if they really give this new Bond a new personality, it feels like every Bond that comes across, they kind of fit the movie to the personality. We'll see what happens when the official casting comes out.
Yep.
Does anybody have a person that they really want though? Do you guys have a person that you would really want to see?
Well, I know there's a lot of talk about Dev Patel. So I would be totally cool with Dev getting that pick. Gosh, I think if you asked me to be like 10 years ago, I think like Michael Fassbender would have been a really good pick, but I think he's just a little too old for it now. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah, probably just Dev, I guess.
Well, we'll see. Hopefully we get a little tease of that with Monkey Man as part of some
That's what I'm excited
new films
to see
coming
that.
Down. Yeah. Yeah, Monkey Man was one of the trailers that has been running pretty consistently at the movie theater, and I in my seat for it. I'm very excited. Just give it all to me, Dev.
Yeah. It looks very good. I'm very excited for that.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting targeted hard for that movie really well. So they know what they're doing.
Let's see. What else do we have to talk about here in the village?
Any recently watched you guys want to talk about?
I recently watched. Funny enough, I recently rewatched and watched the new Roadhouse. I did not have plans on seeing it two times, but it was like a family movie night the other night, and we were just trying to think of some options, just trying to throw out some ideas. We couldn't come up with anything, so then I mistakenly mentioned, well, there's the new Roadhouse movie, and my family didn't see it, so I was like, all right, it looks like I'm in for round two. So I still enjoyed it, but it was just it was just funny rewatching it so soon after I watched it the first time. But I mean, I liked it. A few people who I've seen logged it did not like it as much, but I had a good time. Obviously, yeah, it's not.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's not obviously like the original. They do a lot of, different things, especially with the camera work, which seemed to be like a running topic with a lot of people who logged it. But
interesting.
I enjoyed it. Jake Gyllenhaal was great. Conor McGregor was hilarious.
Heard a lot of reviews about just his performance and physique and appearance alone. So
he has this hilarious walk that he does, and I don't know if it's just for the movie or just how he walks, but it is hilarious just to see him move around.
So you're saying Connor doesn't do a lot of leg days?
No, I think he skips leg day. I think for sure he's skipping leg day.
Uh-oh. Shots
fired. I will keep my opinions to myself around Roadhouse when it comes to this establishment, as that was also my council pick, the original Roadhouse for the original Council 10 of my partner Ash. It's her favorite movie, hands down. We've got the Vinegar Syndrome 4K. We went to see it in the theaters a couple months ago when it ran here in Hollywood. So the original does carry a lot of weight. I've seen a lot of the reviews. Dime has seen it enough for both of us, so that's good. I'll let that simmer down, and maybe I'll get forced to watch it on a plane ride alone where I can quietly stir about all of the things. Basically, what boils down to is, couldn't you have just called it any other thing but Roadhouse? But hey, you know, that's me, and you know, we know where my allegiances lie when it comes to that.
That's right. Really quick, so my last four watched, I guess I'll just do the last three movies I watched. So I was not at the Problemista screening with Dave and Ismail and Ash and Chris. I was at the Lord of the Rings Extended Edition marathon at our Hollywood Theater in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
And that was my entire day, was sitting in a seat for 13 hours. So I got the theater like 9:30. It was a sold out screening, so there's no reserve seating. You just get there first come, first serve. And they had about 30 minutes between movies, so you could stretch, get some snacks, use the bathroom. But it was a great experience. The first Lord of the Rings Fellowship is my favorite. So I mentioned in my Letterboxd review that I did tear up multiple times watching this. You know, you get bowled over by the music, just the dialogue, and the audience reactions was great, and all that stuff. So it was a really pretty fun experience to kind of see all of them just so consistently just drawn out through a course of a day. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. So if you have the stamina and you know, the willpower, it's definitely worth doing the marathon run.
Keyword stamina and willpower there. We try to do the extended versions during the holidays every year, and that's in the comfort of my own home, and I'm still like, pause, stretch, dog walk, let's take a break. Paul's like, I have 15 minutes, eat a slice of pizza, go, go, fast, go.
That's also kind of nice, though, because it's like, I've seen the movie so many times, so I didn't have to be like right at the start of the movie when it starts again. I can like, oh, if I want to take an extra 5 minutes outside and get some air or whatever, there's no rush. So it was casual, but yet strenuous.
Miss out on a couple of those 15 different endings, you know, get out before the traffic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think a big thing, especially in our community, is those movie experiences and meetups like this. Anytime that you can get together. I mean, there have been random times where folks are in the same movie theater, but they're not even meeting up. I remember the movie box incident where I think Kenzo was there and then another villager was there simultaneously, but not together, which is wild. And they were posting pictures, which is super, super cool. yeah, just another way for folks to get to mix in. And, you know, during those theater experiences, if it's a cool, unique experience, we've got a lot of international villagers. So if you're in one of those cool theaters from like 1910, there's actually a channel in Discord. You just want to highlight a couple of those channels, as we always do. Theaters is one. So if you've got a really cool, unique local one, or even one of those Regals that were built in the 1970s that have, you know, a Godzilla neon, something really unique, by all means. Or if you just want to say, hey, this is my Regal, this is where I go, I wish I had something better, that's fine too. We just want to know where you're watching movies, where you're enjoying them, and if you go see them with folks, we'd love to see that as well. And another channel that a lot of folks have been interacting with, especially after award season, is the fashion channel. So we have a lot of folks in there that are throwing in, oh my gosh, did you see who's wearing this on the red carpet? a really great opportunity to also kind of show your day wear or what you've been wearing. There's been some sneaker talk around that. We're recording here on Air Max Day, apropos of that. Yeah, there's one, you know, just a couple extra channels there to think about checking out. You can reduce your overwhelm and just completely kind of mute those out. And you won't have to worry about too much, you know, other than, you know, keeping up with, you know, where Andy is at. Dime, speaking of, emergency tracker in Andy 5000 tracker. Dime, where is Andy now?
Well, it's funny. This is, so like the last recording I was on, I said, you know, Andy has been very quiet. You know, it just hasn't been doing a whole lot. The last I saw, he was international. As far as now, Andy is still quiet. I cannot locate this guy again still. But the investigation still rolls on. I got boots on the ground where, you know, we got agents all around trying to track this guy. But can't find him. So, you know, but he'll pop up. I'll find him. He'll pop up somewhere.
He wants to be found. I think that's the deal. He wants to be found.
Speaking of investigations, our boy Willem Dafoe was doing a lot of questioning when it came to Christian Bale as far as his whereabouts and restaurant going. But, Paul, what is this movie about?
American Psycho. A wealthy New York investment banking executive hides his alternative psychopathic ego from his coworkers and friends as he escalates deeper into his illogical, gratuitous fantasies. Simple.
Is it though? It's just surface level, right? You know, nothing to see here.
Mm-hmm.
Just simple. Yeah, I don't necessarily know if that will do the movie justice, but to kind of start off, has anybody actually read the book that this is based on?
Yeah, so I read the book when I was in college, so back in like 2008. So I read the book after seeing the movie, and I remember parts of it. I remember being pretty boring. There tend to be a lot of just empty chapters where just like nothing happens, and I obviously that's the point, where there's chapters where it's just like Patrick and Evelyn talking about where they should have dinner and who they should invite, and they just go in circles and they end up talking for so long they end up not going out for dinner. So it's just kind of like, or there's a chapter where they talk about different mineral waters. It's just so much stuff, and there's of course like the horrendous violence of it. So it's just, the movie's like super tame compared to the book, but if you like the movie, I mean, you might get more out of the book. I don't know. It's definitely a trial.
Do you think the film, you said you watched the film first and then you read the book?
Yeah. So I saw the movie, back, and I was like probably like 14, 15. And, yeah, the movie's essentially just kind of like almost a Spark Notes version of the book, where it's just kind of like the high points of Patrick's character and his world and everything. But the book goes so much deeper, and there's so many other murders and events that happen in between. The book also has mentioning of his brother, Sean Bateman, that's in Bret Easton Ellison's other book, The Rules of Attraction. So there's no mentioning that in the movie, but in The Rules of Attraction in the movie, there's a mention of Patrick. So the book has a lot more tie-outs than the movie does. The movie's much more just kind of standalone.
Interesting. Yeah. But does it capture, mm-hmm. you feel that it captured the tone after seeing both and reading it? Do you think, other than the shortening of kind of those peaks and valleys, do you think they did a good job? Because I know there was a little bit of discussion, some interviews with the director where, you know, comments where she even kind of thought that she might not have done the ending justice. You might have pulled the punches too quickly. And so I didn't, was just wondering if you, as somebody who is the only one here who has read the book, if you feel that that tone, maybe not the changes at the end, but just the tone overall, if that was matched. Because I feel like with art, you know, especially when you're transitioning from a literary to a film genre, mm-hmm. you can kind of make those changes and not necessarily feel a difference, or you make those changes and it feels like a completely different story. It sounds like it's pretty consistent other than
I think it kind of nails some of the big points on the head pretty well. Like you said, like between a book and a film, like a book you can kind of take as much time as you want to with, but then a movie you only have a certain amount of time before it starts getting cut or you start losing scenes or whatever. But I think kind of the overall points are kind of made. I think they did a good job with it. Yeah. Except, yeah, for the ending, like you said, how it was kind of interpreted a bit differently, all that stuff. But I kind of don't mind how the ending was done. Doesn't really bother me. I know some feel different about it.
Was there a part in the book that you wished was in the movie? Or a part in the book that you were excited to read knowing what happens in the film?
I think there was actually one chapter, I think, where Patrick meets with an ex-girlfriend and he's like sweating bullets meeting her and like is nervous. And then he writes her like this poem and like reads it to her at the restaurant. And it's like really awkward. And then like he ends up like taking her home, killing her, or like torturing her and then killing her. I'm obviously not going to go into detail what happens with that, but I think just with Christian Bale's performance, that would have been kind of an interesting, fun scene to kind of see him sweat even more than what he's kind of used to with, like when he sees Kimball and he's just like profusely sweating. So I think that would have been kind of a fun scene to kind of see at first until it, you know, kind of devolves into that.
Yeah, I think obviously the movie is going to rest on Christian Bale and his performance as the titular character. And the sweating is one of the things where is he sweating or is he just shiny from all of like the face stuff that he normally does? There's so many weird different scenes of just like the faces that he makes. Obviously they're memeable beyond belief. Dime, was there a certain like not sweaty face, or was there a particular face that he made, or, you know, the gifts that you're always people are always using? Is there one that always comes back to you no matter how many times you watch this? You're just waiting for him to do this.
Yeah, there is one. It's one that I've seen many times. I think I might have used it a couple of times. It's when all the executives, all the businessmen, they're all in this like room and they're discussing their business cards and like the shades of white that they're using. And so it's the one scene where I forgot his name, but he shows his business card and Patrick is looking at it and he just has this sort of like very angry blank stare. And he's just like trying, it almost looks like he's trying to like burn it with his eyes. He's just very blank, and it's hilarious. And I was waiting for that moment to come up, because like you said, there are so many gifs and memes that have been created from this movie alone, just from his faces, because out of context, they work for a lot of situations and they're just too funny. So that particular scene I was waiting for, because, and it's also such a close shot on his face that it cracks me up.
Yeah. Definitely. I think one of my notes is the way that Bale is able to project that completely just dead-eyed stare, like that complete disconnect of, regardless of whether he is thinking absolute insane murderous thoughts or he's disassociated to be thinking about what he's going to do for his gym routine in the morning, his ability to keep that like creepy smile, wide eyes, and just look in a way that under any other circumstances, not in the 80s, you know, talking about the kind of the general culture that the movie takes place in, and you know what the movie is trying to say. It's funny that, you know, he is able to completely personify that gratuitous outward kind of smize, if you will, where in any other kind of normal social setting, anyone would look at a person like that, again, regardless of creepy thoughts, and be a little worried at about what they're showing to the rest of the world. Whereas like in the 80s, people are so self-indulgent, so focused on themselves, about getting their own, moving ahead in the world, getting to the top, that they just see that kind of Potemkin village face and they're like, oh yep, that's normal, here we go, like I'm working, just keep, let's keep going. And I think that's one of the cool things about this movie too, was the editing and the way that they were able to play with the idea of, is he actually physically doing these in the real world, or is this just some machination in his head where he's constantly just you know, circling the drain, going through these erratic thoughts, and then kind of coming back to life, because you know the 80s is such a quote unquote shallow time where everybody's again worried about themselves. How does that come across? And I think that the way that they did that editing, you know, I don't know if y'all felt the same way, but I feel like they were able to find that nice balance of, is he really, or is he not? And even, you know, to our earlier conversation about, was the ending worthy or not worthy of the story? I think ultimately it does meet what the original, you know, half of, you know, the earlier points of the movie are, is that ultimately it's not going to matter because people are worried about themselves when it comes down to it. So I thought that was an excellent way of balancing it. And I don't know if there were, if you caught the same thing, or if there were certain scenes where you really jumped out at you this time that really kind of either put that point home.
Yeah. I mean, I think one scene specifically that stands out to me is when, after he kills Paul Allen and he's like carrying the body through the lobby, and you see like the trail of blood coming from the bag, the overnight bag or whatever. So it's like, it's the shot inside the lobby, and then it cuts to outside. But if you look in the background of that second shot, you don't see a bloodline. So it's like, that's almost, I don't know if it's either just like an oversight in production, they just forgot to like add that back in when they did the pickup or whatever, or if that's just like part of the psyche of Patrick Bateman, where it actually, it's not happening, and it's just like a standard, you know, bag that he's just carrying out. So I think that to a degree might say something. But that actually kind of almost kind of brings me to my first big point that I just love about this movie so much, is like the concept of like, nobody can certainly identify anybody else. It's like from scene one, they think they're seeing someone from across the way, but it's not that person. They think it's somebody else. And they, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And my favorite bit is when Patrick's carrying out the body, and then Lewis catches him on the street, and he's like, Patrick, is that you? And he goes, no, Lewis, it's not me. You're mistaken. Like, yes. Something about that delivery from both sides is so, so funny to me. And it just keeps going to like a hysterical end. So I think that kind of proves also to like your point, Dave, of just like, it's the 80s. Everyone's just all about themselves, and they're not looking at identity of anybody else that's around them. Yeah, I just think it's super funny.
And that aligns a lot with kind of the homogeneity of the 80s, is that was really the full tilt marketing of, you know, hey, if you want to be successful, you got to buy this. If you want to be the best, you have to work at this. And, you know, all of these, I'm going to just go ahead and kind of spoil a little one of the, we'll go to an early villager review, because I think it's kind of apropos of where we are in the conversation. But our good friend Kenzo reviewed it in September 10th of 2022, and they said, I really enjoyed this. I'm not sure how to articulate the best thoughts on it at the moment, because it's such an overwhelming movie. But I do know the fact that this was written and directed by a woman is a major part why its deconstruction of misogyny is so successful. And I think that's really key to how well this, again, plays, especially when it came out in 2000, kind of the end of the naivety of the 90s, if you will. We've kind of gone through a generation of seeing the 80s and the pendulum swinging back, towards the 90s. I think it was really important, especially as you can see throughout the story, kind of all of the cracks and the what folks would look at as the, you know, quote unquote Reagan morning in America was not morning in America for everybody. But for those folks who wanted things, you had to have X, Y, Z, you know, and they talk a lot about it with, you know, the brands, to your point, Paul, that moment where he's like, no, Lewis, this isn't me. And then doesn't he mention, like, that's a wonderful bag that you have. Like, where did you get that day
bag? He gets distracted by it. And he's like, oh, that is a wonderful overnight bag.
Yeah, wonderful overnight bag. But even, you know, so they bring out all of these brands and, you know, doing research for this today. They went to all of the brands that were in the book, and half the brands were like, yes, you can use us, but you can't use us if Christian Bale is in the scene because we don't want to be associated with that. And the bag in this scene was actually supposed to be a Comme des Garçons bag, but they said no. And so Jean-Paul Gaultier was like, sure, you can use our name. And so it's just very funny that even now you can, they're looking back and brands themselves are like, I don't want to be used in this recreation of the 80s. Sir, ma'am, sexualized corporation, you did this. You did this. You put your brand out there. You know, Rolex, watch talk, hashtag watch talk. Yeah. You know, Rolex is the big timepiece of the day. And even in this movie, when there's a moment after a scene where they're all laying in bed and one of the girls rolls over and hits his wrist and is like, don't touch the watch. In the book, it's like, don't touch the Rolex. But Rolex was like, we don't want to be associated with this. So I think it's very funny. A lot of people, even companies now, are looking back at the 80s going, maybe we invested a little too much in that that marketing and less in the communities and the spirit around folks where we should be now.
Well, it's funny too that you brought up the brands, because it made me think about, as far as whenever he would bring up the music that you listen to, because he was, you know, name dropping a lot of artists. One that comes to mind is Phil Collins, and how he has all this like extensive knowledge of like when the album came out, when the singles came out, like how well it did, you know, as far as the genres that he played with, things like that. And I found it very interesting that he knew all these things, but also in this very diabolical, psychotic way that he listened to this kind of music, given the nature of the things that he's doing. So it was like, it's kind of like very like night and day in a sense. Especially with the scene when he's walking into the office and I can't remember the name of the song, but it's a very popular song. And he's like,
The Walking on Sunshine.
Yeah, exactly. So he's blaring that through his headphones, but you know, like deep inside, like this is a very dark man, but he's listening to one of the most like light hearted, happy songs that I've heard before. And so, so that's why when you brought up the brands, it made me think like, well, I wonder if these, you know, sort of like music companies, artists were okay with them being associated with the movie in the sense of like what he's doing and how it's being portrayed.
Yeah, that makes that's also a good point, because the music itself kind of juxtapose very well the songs chosen, as great of 80s tunes as they are. The lyrics specifically, the way that they're placed in the movie, are also representative of that dichotomy of, you know, beauty and sophistication on the outside, but inside you're just vapid and empty, to the point where it's just all you have to do is offer, like you were saying, Dime, all Bateman has to offer are these kind of music review platitudes, in the same way that somebody on Letterboxd would be like, you know, maybe you don't understand French cinema, so you're going to give this 3 stars. Well, you don't understand Huey Lewis's new album because you haven't listened to the 3 before that. So you're just a real music neophyte, man. You know? So like again, and I a lot of that goes in the big, I think it's funny that kind of each crucial point in kind of Bateman's mental detachment usually incurs when something does not meet that external cultural expectation, or somebody has bested him in reaching that first. Back to your point, Dime, with the, you know, the gif of like the sweaty face when he sees that bone card, like, you know, or the card that's like, oh, it's bone, but it's a different typeset, and it's something is slightly different that really, I cannot believe I didn't think of that, and for that you are going to pay. Uh-huh. And so it's also very funny where there's also a level of gratuitousness in the sense that, okay, in the 80s, you wanted what you want, you went and got it by any means necessary. And in this particular case, any means necessary means a chrome sword to the face of your nearest, you know, nearest competitor.
Yeah, and that was also one of my points, too, that it seemed like if anybody bested him, it just seemed like he just had to, you know, just go out and do something. Like, if his ego was, like, hurt in any sense, he just had to just act on it. And it just, and like you said, it just seemed like that was just kind of the time that they were living in, that everyone's just always competing. And especially in that sort of, like, business executive world, you know, everyone's just trying to stay on top. Everyone's just trying to be better than the next person. And so with somebody like Patrick, who was already clinically insane, if you want to say, him having his ego bruised and always somebody, you know, trying to be on top of him, just, like, did not sit right with him, like, at all.
Yeah, I would agree. And, like, that's what I love about the Paul Allen character, because it's, like, literally everything that he just is just trying to get to that next level, where just, like, he says a comment, but Paul Allen has something above it that kind of dominates it. So it's like, where do you tan? He's like, oh, I tan salon. I got a tanning bed at home. You should look into it. So it just, like, it's just the little things that just needle under his skin. And then just, like, finally, or like when he fails with the reservation, how there's no one there at the Texarkana restaurant. Like, he's just disappointed and just ends up getting him drunk and, yeah, taking care of business. So
do you think that under the circumstances, there was any off-ramp in that movie for a character like that to maybe not necessarily, we all know that the ending, he doesn't necessarily get away with it. It kind of goes through some mental anguish. He thinks he's going to be interviewed by, you know, or he's being interviewed by Willem Dafoe. Some of the information is coming out that isn't quite aligning. At what point in the movie, or if at all, would you think is the best off-ramp considering, like, the culture? Do you think it was like his only option was to kind of white knuckle and push through the way that he did in hopes that his confession in some way, you know, his kind of release at that moment gave him personally the necessary kind of release that he needed overall to kind of maybe extinguish part of that malevolence that's inside him? Do you think there's any, were there any points, or was he just kind of on this train from the beginning? You're kind of stuck with it. You're stuck in the culture. There's no way out. So again, white knuckle it. Good luck. Hopefully you don't end up in jail, die of an overdose, lose all your stocks, whatever. Have fun. Was there any part, do you think there was any spot in this movie that could have happened, or the story could have kind of quote unquote come to a different happy ending in kind of a more modern sense, as opposed to the 80s emptiness that it did?
I think from my perspective, I think that there was really no other way that he could have gone away with doing anything, just with what he did, like just white knuckling through the interviews, and just hopefully, like, somebody else's testimony can kind of support that. Or there's that, again, like that level of confusion of identity, where it's like, am I saw him here? Am I saw him there? I had lunch with him a week ago. Maybe I didn't, or maybe it's somebody else. And then I think it also just kind of plays to Patrick's character, how he's just like, has to just like be the alpha and just not back down under any means and show any kind of form of weakness. Because I think that starts to kind of like crumble with his like, his anxiety that you kind of see towards the end where, you know, after he kills Christy and then he breaks up with Evelyn, it just like kind of starts falling apart. And then we see what happens where he gives that big long monologue to his lawyer over the phone and just kind of devolves. So I think it was just a matter of time. But I think psychologically there was no way out.
Yeah, I agree with everything what Paul said. I don't think there was no way. I think given the circumstance, this was, it seemed like this was like his kind of like option, sort of like the lane that he was going down. And I thought that when he confessed all the things to his lawyer, I actually thought that things would turn in a way where, in a sense, that maybe people would see these sort of like red flags that they probably weren't paying attention to the first time, and then they will sort of like think back and like, oh, you're getting like such and such makes sense now. But yeah, I agree to literally everything that Paul said. It all makes sense.
Yeah, I think I concur with both of you that I think this is not just a story to kind of portray that particular mentality, but more importantly to kind of just the lack of pulling punches, I think, was super critical in this. There was, you know, a lot of discussions online about things that the murder scenes weren't the issue. It was actually kind of the way that some of the females looked during the sex scenes, that they were not into it and not giving that kind of Hollywood pornographic image, you know, one basically just like looked and was like, I'm not into this, and started to leave before she was taken out by a falling chainsaw. In the story here, it's there was always an uncomfortability in the sense that this was probably one of the better mirrors of that particular time in a film, obviously coming from the book as well. But I think I was briefly, you know, I would say understanding of the 80s because I was born in the 80s. Shout out to me. But more importantly, I think it does a great job of representing that particular time in society and makes it so that you're not looking back at it with rose-colored nostalgia in the way that folks these days are. Like, let's go back to the Reagan era. Like, okay, you want to go back? Let me tell you what's happening in the Reagan era. Like, Times Square was not Times Square. You know, it was not Disney-fied back then. There were a lot of things that... there are a lot of inequities that are still very, very much happening today. A lot of inequities have exacerbated since the Reagan era. And so I think it did a really good job, even with whatever the director feels about the ending. I think they did a wonderful job of being able to harness the story and to harness what they're actually trying to say about this time and this culture. And yeah, hats off to Christian Bale. As much as we've heard about his on-screen persona may look like some of the things that he does off-screen, unfortunately, in the way that he prepares for a character. But his representation on screen, the fact that half of the crew didn't even know that he was not American until they rapped and he dropped the accent and people were like, hold on, is he doing a different accent for an upcoming role? No. I only heard him break a few times. There was one in the monologue where he was kind of getting loose and you could hear a drop of a Welsh drop here and there. But for the most part,
I didn't catch that.
I think he really, really nailed it. And again, you know, back to my point about the eyes, not many people could have done it better. So cheers to American Psycho. Before we kind of get into our final ratings or anything, we haven't covered on the points here, gents?
I have just a few random observations I just wanted to throw out. Justin Theroux dancing in that opening sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It kills me. He's doing like that like side hustle kind of like just... Oh, it's so funny.
The white man's overbite.
Oh my God. He's so confident. Like, his head doesn't even like move. It's just his whole body's moving except his head. It's hilarious. The fact that his kitchen looks like a morgue with all the stainless steel is funny.
Yes. Oh yeah.
When he puts on the ice pack, it's like that, just all just chrome or silk, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when he meets Veronica at the dry cleaners, the fact that he just like shoves his like bloody sheets at her and just like leaves. It's like, that's just so stupid. And he's like the cigar. He just looks, it's so comical. It just cracks
cranberry orange juice, Paul. Come on now.
Yeah, exactly. Cran apple. Also wanted to shout out the watch Patrick was wearing was the Rolex Datejust 16013. So Danny, if you're listening to this, that's the Rolex watch Patrick was wearing.
Just sell a few sneakers for that.
Exactly. And then a few bits of trivia that were kind of fun. This might be kind of common knowledge about the movie that director Mary Harron directed Defoe in three different ways in the initial interview scene. So one way was that he knew it was Patrick. One way was that he was not sure. And then one way he absolutely knew it was him that did it. So then they had all these different ways to edit kind of for the final film. So that was kind of cool. And then two of the names were changed from the book to the movie. So originally it was Paul Owen in the book, and then it's Timothy Price. But then became known that those were two actual people in Wall Street. So they had to change that for the movie. So that's why it became Timothy Bryce and Paul Allen.
Oh, wow. Look at that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought his morning routine is just insane. Just all the things that he has to do to have his perfect skin. I mean, once he opens the cabinet, it's just like, my goodness, that's like a lot of products to use in the morning. I mean, I think from what I remember, I mean, he goes through this step-by-step process, but I was very curious on like how long it takes to do each thing, you know, in the morning. Because like for me, I move slowly in the morning. So that if I had all those products, it would take me forever. I would not.
And he works out in the morning too. It's like, yeah. I don't have time for that.
So it's like his morning routine is just...
Every female listener right now is like, get in line, gentlemen. Welcome to getting ready in the morning.
So I thought.
But a dime to your point, fun fact about that facial routine, Christian Bale actually did that routine.
Oh.
Like 6 months before the movie in order to make his face as glossy and gleaming and tight as possible to kind of match the routine. And I think a lot of the routine that he monologues is what he actually did in order to get there.
Wow. Yeah. And we were just talking about what he does to get into character, get into role. So now knowing that, that is, wow. That's another good trivia. Wow. That's crazy. And then, yeah, speaking too with his workouts. Well, one of his workouts when he's watching, he has like a horror movie playing in the background while he's doing like his ab crunches. I just thought, like, what? Like, how is this motivating you? This is weird. This is crazy.
I think it was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, wasn't it?
I think it was. Yeah.
You see Leatherface, yeah, with the chainsaw, yeah.
Yeah. My goodness. And then one of the lines that it cracked me up. I couldn't believe it. So Patrick is out to dinner with Paul Allen, and the waiter comes over and he wants to read the specials. And so the waiter says, like, do you want to hear the specials? And then Patrick says, not if you want to keep your spleen. And I'm like, wow. he just says it like no thought. He just put it out there. And I'm like, Mike.
Like he said it before like a dozen times in different restaurants or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like he's probably been walked up to constantly, and waiters and waitresses are asking him about the specials, and then he's probably just over time just got irritated and just had to just say something to just have them walk away.
One of my favorite lines is like in the almost, it's one of the first lines almost. It's where Van Patten walks into frame and he just sits down and he goes, they don't have a good bathroom to do coke in. It's just like, it's such a throwaway line, but it's so funny. Just, I don't know why.
Well, then later on you see the bathroom that they're actually doing coke in, and it's like, oh, double wides, you can see everybody's, yeah, head up top, and then the Joker, like, mm-hmm, hey, keep it down, I'm trying to do drugs over here, like, what?
Yeah, like,
we're all in this. Yeah, the dark comedy
here.
Yeah, we're all trying to do drugs.
He's like, it's too light. I want to sprinkle it on my oatmeal. Yeah, that's so good.
Oh, my goodness. And I feel like that, too, is like another thing like of his time that people in that world were always just constantly just doing drugs wherever they could. And the fact that they had a bathroom made just for that is wild.
Yeah. You got to know your clientele, sure. Right?
Yeah, exactly. You got to have them come back.
Yeah, I think the discussion around always kind of having to be on and like representative of like the elites of elites. Patrick doesn't break even in the midst of like he's mid-coitus flexing to himself in the mirror, like just that level of self, like to take that as part of again the experience that you're having, but again, you know, to Dime's point about treating the waiter like garbage, just like I'll cut your spleen out, the way that he is able to, I don't want to say like code switch, but switch between like the professional, hey girl, can you take your dress off? And then immediately go back to like, he's talking about the music, but then he'll throw in like, you know, don't look at it. Get to work. You know, that type of thing. Like just so coldly that there's no humanity ultimately with anything that happens. And that goes back to, you know, everybody, all of the people that are working there, in the company. It's not about humanity. It's about getting forward and achieving, beyond, leaving whatever wake you need to leave behind. And so, I think fantastic movie, great representation of the time, and, grateful to hang out with y'all and talk about this. Let's go ahead and, give our final reviews here. I gave it 4.5 stars on this rewatch. I think many, many years ago, to Paul's point, I probably watched this early 18, you know, 19 years old, and decided that Christian Bale was a psychopath. We nailed that, obviously. I think the more that I watch it, and especially this recent rewatch, specifically around that editing, really jumped out to me, and being able to kind of find that balance between is this or isn't this, and using the culture to kind of keep that mixed and motion. So I gave that 4.5 stars this rewatch. Dime, what did you give it for this rewatch?
So funny enough, according to my Letterboxd, I seen this twice before this third rewatch, but was very odd is that I don't remember watching it the first two times, because this third rewatch felt like the first time watch. But so it was cool to kind of, I guess, kind of go back, but in the same way, sort of like visit it for the very first time. But on this rewatch, I gave it 4 stars. I very much enjoyed it. Yeah, Christian Bale was, in a strange way, phenomenal in this role. I mean, yeah, a complete psychopath, but he played it very, very well. I don't know if I could think of another actor that could have done it in the way that he did. I also thought it was funny that Paul Allen kind of looked like Patrick, in a sense, with the slick back hair and the suits and things like that. I thought that was very interesting. But yeah, I mean, I very much enjoyed it, very much of his time. Insane though, a lot of things are going on, comical at a lot of moments, especially any moments that he's being interviewed by Willem Dafoe. Those interactions were great. But yeah, I had a good time. 4 stars.
Huzzah. Nice. Paul?
So I gave this 5 stars. It's one of my favorite cult movie. It's just like endlessly quotable. It's hilarious. It's also brutal. It's just a weird, dark satire. Christian Bale, as we've just been chiming about, it just has a great performance. And like Dime said, like I couldn't imagine anyone else playing this role. I mean, they could, but it just wouldn't be, I think, as effective. It's just kind of one of those deep cut favorites that I love. So yeah, 5 stars.
Nice. Sweet. Well, we've gone ahead and got a few of our ratings on the board, and we've also gone ahead and pulled up a few villager reviews. Let's see here. Paul, I think you have one from our sweet host of 70mm, Danny Haas.
Yeah. go ahead and read that off. So yes, our famous artist friend, 70 millimeter host Danny Haas, gave American Psycho 3 stars. Quote, it was good. I just really disliked the ending, or maybe I just didn't get it or whatever. The best scenes I had already seen over time. So I do know I need to use the returning videotapes bit more in my everyday life. So that was pretty good. And he watched that on October 21st, 2021.
And our next review comes in from Hillary. She watched this July 7th of 2022. Yeah, it writes, you know, sometimes a movie just perpetually exists at the top of Letterboxd and you decide it's finally time to watch it. And you get far enough to see the iconic scenes and finally understand the references and you say, okay, I've had enough here, let's call it a day. Business card scene is incredible. Skincare scene enjoyable. Overall, I get the whole thing happening here, but no thanks, not for me. No, I understand that. And unless I'm reading this incorrectly, I don't think I see any stars on this, but it sounds like she liked it.
Oh, no,
just
stars.
A log, no,
huh?
Rating.
Just a commentary rating. Interesting. Yeah, and our last review comes from Liam White, reviewed it on November 1st, 2021, gave American Psycho 4.5 stars. Read an article that Mary Harron admit that she quote-unquote failed with the ending, that she wished she had kept the twist a bit more open-ended. Despite that, this movie fucking rocks. It is so darkly hilarious in the best ways possible, and Christian Bale just fucking sells it. Yeah, I think all of these reviews do a great job of kind of encapsulating what we've been talking about tonight, so thank you so much, villagers.
I'm shocked we never used the returning videotapes line, because that's like probably the line everyone kind of remembers from the movie. I'm just surprised we never brought it up in our conversation.
I know. Which it's is like funny, because we brought it up in our house. We were like, I should start using that. And people were like, who returns videotapes now? Like, well, let us tell you about a wonderful cinema club that we belong to that loves physical media.
Exactly.
Oh, good old times. But as always, amazing movie, amazing discussion, and amazing possum.
And we're another episode down. Pew, pew, pew! We're still looking, you know, we're still looking through the research records to figure out how Poltergeist won. Maybe it was the village worshiping at the altar of Spielberg again and all those Amblin vibes. Or maybe we just really wanted that Danny art because we know how good it can always be. Maybe we were possessed. I'm not really sure. But again, you know. That's how it rolls in the old VHS village.
It's very true. It's very true. But as we always say, it's a villager vote. So when it comes to the villager vote, anything is possible. And it leaves us with amazing movies left to cover.
That's right. And in a few weeks, our big season 2 finale. And when I mean big, we jam-packed the studio with a bit of everything. So we've got returning hosts, new hosts, and a cult classic film, and a lot of air fresheners. So keep your eyes on those Letterboxd feeds for some hints.
And with season 2 ending very soon, we're already planning our next season with a few new innovations and ideas in the mix. But as always, you can send us feedback at 70mmrejected@gmail.com, or just come and let us know how we're doing in the Discord, because we'll always be available. We're always there. We're always having some fun. We're always chatting up. So, you know, we'll be there. And with that being said, goodbye.
Seventy Millimeter Rejected is an Opossum production. Original artwork by Paul. Kinda original music by Dave with an assist from 70mm. The 70mm Rejected team includes Kirby, Latdad, Dime, Paul, RWT Chats, Bex, Grogu Dave, Josh, Nolan, Yoev, Ron, Trainer, and Ben Z. If you'd like to join us in the silliness, ping one of us in Discord. And if you'd like to support our friends at 70mm and upgrade to villager status, you can do so using the links in the notes. Goodbye. Thank you.
This is an Opossums podcast.